The Three Martini Lunch is on vacation this week. Jim and Greg will be back with new episodes on Monday, September 11th. The following is a best of The Three Martini Lunch. In this edition, we examine why President Trump's tough talk on North Korea isn't cause for all the hand-wringing that the mainstream media would have us believe. We look at the puff piece from The Washington Post on anarchists, and we look at CNN's curious decision to fire Trump supporter Jeffrey Lord.
Now, The Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of The Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives to close out the work week. And Jim, we start with the good martini, but it's a martini that could be slightly controversial, especially with the chattering classes inside the Washington Beltway, because they're really, really worried that Donald Trump's rhetoric is the main reason why we could be on the brink of a nuclear war. But let's start, first of all, with Trump's latest comment. We talked about his fire and fury comment a little bit earlier in the week, and then he had a brief session with reporters, kind of shouting at them from outside the golf club clubhouse there at Bedminster, New Jersey. And here's what he had to say when someone asked him if he thought that his rhetoric about the fire and the fury went too far.
The people that were questioning that statement, was it too tough? Maybe it wasn't tough enough. They've been doing this to our country for a long time, for many years. And it's about time that somebody stuck up for the people of this country and for the people of other countries. So if anything, maybe that statement wasn't tough enough.
Oh, the networks didn't like that one. Here's CBS News and former CIA official, I think he was the acting director at one time, Michael Morell, saying that this is really, really troubling.
I think the president's statements of the last 2 days are reckless. And I think they're reckless for two reasons. One is that Kim Jong-un has been shown to be provocable. And so this playground game of dare, double dare, is dangerous. The second reason that is that statements such as this box the president in from a policy perspective.
So, Jim, it's a little bit like parenting here. It doesn't do you much good to make threats if the person you're threatening doesn't think you're actually going to make good on it. So we don't know what impact it's actually having on Kim Jong-un, but he's certainly got some new things to think about that he didn't have from previous administrations.
I think that's accurate. But when Trump says, I think it may not have been strong enough, fire, fury, there's really only one other F word he could have used there. And it's probably best that he didn't. Look, I was lucky enough to chat with somebody who'd been kind of plugged in with the you know, U.S. defense establishment, so to speak. And we were discussing deterrence theory. And this is the kind of influenced the way I wrote about this in the Morning Jolt today. That, look, if you want peace on the Korean Peninsula, if you do not want war to break out, then you need to deter North Korea from taking further aggressive actions, right? And we've discussed earlier this week, they have at times shelled South Korean islands. They have sank a South Korean ship. Obviously, they've been firing their missiles, and they announced they have plans to fire their missiles, test fire their missiles within 20 miles of Guam. Look, if you fire within 20 miles of Guam, and what happens if you're 20 miles off? You accidentally hit the island, civilians, or U.S. forces there. If you want to deter them from taking further actions that are likely to provoke a larger confrontation, then the other side needs to believe that you are ready to fight, that you, and you are willing to fight. There are a lot of times where Trump has bluster and clearly isn't thinking before he speaks or he goes off on these Twitter tirades. But in this case, it actually makes sense. North Korea has to believe that we have no fear of getting into a war with them, because much as we would hate to see Seoul get seriously hit, as much as we would hate to see South Korea and Japan hit, and as much as we know that there is now a greater than zero chance that they could hit us with a nuclear weapon, we can utterly destroy them. This is our deterrent. This is our, you don't want to go down this road. You don't want to put, you know, you don't want to take one step more, because that increases the odds of the utter devastation of your country. You can't do that by taking the Michael Moreau approach to that. You know, is Tillerson attempting the good cop routine while Trump and Mattis do a bit more of a bad cop? Sure. This idea, by the way, that Kim Jong-un is provocable. Look, if this guy's willing to start a war over an insult from a foreign leader, is that really our problem or his? Like, oh, don't do it. You could set him off. Okay, but didn't he do a hacking attack on Hollywood because of that crazy James Franco movie a little while ago?
Yes.
I mean, yes. Like, well, don't make movies that could offend him, right? I mean, like, just how much are we supposed to alter our behavior because of his danger, the dangerousness of his behavior? This is how these rogue states get leverage, right? That, you know, well, they're crazy. We better not do anything that irks them. And as a result of that, we don't get to pursue what we want because of fear of setting them off. Meanwhile, they constantly do things, including kill people, and they have no concern about setting us off. Now all of a sudden, both Trump's reputation and his rhetoric are, you know, arguably working in our favor here, because now the North Koreans, as you mentioned, have this new X factor to think about. They knew Barack Obama was not likely to respond rashly or suddenly or aggressively to their behavior. And in fact, I don't believe the U.S. took any major significant, you know, we might fly our planes near their airspace as a demonstration of force or something like that. Trump could react very differently. And hopefully somebody in North Korea's high command grasps that and recognizes, look, if we keep doing what we've been doing for the past couple of decades, the U.S. might respond the same way or they may respond very differently. I was talking to these folks last night. We realized the moment the North Koreans started testing intercontinental ballistic missiles, we should have started hitting their launch pads. We should have demonstrated, not a full-on, all-out war, but we should have done something to demonstrate you can't shoot missiles over Japan. You can't shoot random missiles towards your neighbors, even if it ends up landing in the ocean because it's just too dangerous and we want to deter this, much like the airstrike against the Syrian airfield where they used chemical weapons earlier this year. And we didn't. And now as a result of that, North Korea basically believes there's not that short of like directly striking at U.S. forces, which is what my fear is that the next, you know, we want to draw that very clear red line there. And for obvious reasons, in the previous administration, people aren't so sure if a U.S. red line is a red line. Now, should, you know, Trump have used the term, if they threaten us, we'll strike them? Probably not. We have a circumstance with both sides are pledging a really strong, tough, destructive, retaliatory strike, but nobody wants to take the first punch, throw the first punch, so to speak. I'm hoping it stays that way. But in order to prevent North Korea from throwing that first punch, they have to know that we are really willing to throw that second punch and inflict an unbelievable amount of damage because of that. So in this case, I see Trump's rhetoric, you know, as heated as it is, as serving a purpose in U.S. policy to enhance the likelihood of deterrence.
Jim, a couple of very quick follow-ups on this, since we have two lovely other martinis to get to that are bad and crazy. What do you make, first of all, of the media essentially putting Trump and Kim on the same crazy plane in terms of equally responsible for this? And in some ways, that Trump's rhetoric would actually be the thing that would be to blame if this ever does come to actual blows.
There are a couple of media's bad habits all coming to the fore here. Some of this, obviously, is the knee-jerk, reflexive opposition to Trump. Obviously, the media does not like Trump, and that they usually see what he does in the worst possible light. But I also noticed, I think probably the media story where this seemed most vivid to me. Edward Snowden defects, starts talking a great deal about what the NSA is doing. Some of the things he reveals about how they can gather information on U.S. citizens is deeply concerning, and I think is a legitimate issue. And a lot of what he's discussing are how we, you know, were able to monitor foreign powers, which is pretty much the job of the NSA and not a scandal in any way, shape, or form. But it quickly turned into Edward Snowden, hero or traitor. And enormous, I don't know about you, Greg, I remember an enormous amount of coverage of his hot girlfriend in Hawaii and all the Instagram pictures of her and stuff like that. But it very quickly turned into a story about what an institution, what an organization was doing, the NSA, to a story of a person, Edward Snowden. What do you think of him? Is he a hero? Is he a traitor? And oh, by the way, it's that totally binary choice, right? You can't say, oh, you know, some of the stuff he revealed was good. Some of the stuff he revealed, he shouldn't have revealed. And this idea of, look, what is the threat of North Korea? Kim Jong-un is a crazy nut job. But if he were to die tomorrow of a heart attack, and judging by his weight, that's not unthinkable, you would have a circumstance in which the next either member of the family or general who took over, they might be more stable and you know, less nutty and less provocative and less erratic than Kim Jong-un, or maybe not. We do, you know, right now, we don't have great intelligence about the chain of command and how that sort of thing would work out in North Korea. So really deep down, the problem with North Korea is not Kim Jong-un personally. It's not this one guy. He's just the useful face of this regime. The problem is the regime. The problem is this totalitarian, brutal, paranoid regime that runs the country as a giant prison camp that is constantly breaking treaties, threatening its neighbors, and doing stuff and doing actions like that. It is the media's appetite for oversimplification. It is the appetite for simple narratives to turn this into Trump versus Kim Jong-un, who's going to win, when it very much should be seen as, no, it is the regime of North Korea against just about everybody except China and how this is going to sort out. That's a much bigger deal than, you know, what do you think of Trump?
Last question on this topic. If, in fact, they fire those missiles towards Guam, good target practice for our missile defense system?
You'd think so, right? I mean, you know, at that point, they're in international waters. We have every right to shoot them down. It would probably irk them. The only risk to that is if we try and we don't work.
Yes.
Does that set off new levels of concern amongst our allies and amongst the American people and things like that? By the way, they may not go through with this this missile test and aiming towards Guam, because for them, if this missile test doesn't work, well, then all of a sudden it's an enormous embarrassment on their side.
Right.
I would be very surprised if we were not, you know, preparing some sort of method to track those missiles very accurately, and at the very least run a simulation of whether we could knock them down if we do not actually fire at them. They may determine that they're not that shooting them down is the risk of our missile defense not working doesn't make us want to have an actual live fire test. But on the other hand, there's a part of me that says, you know what, you may never get better practice than this. I'd be surprised if we did not at least attempt that. And conceivably, we're talking about something that might defuse it. Think about how much easier everyone would breathe if North Korea tries to fire these missiles and a U.S. missile defense system shoots them down. All of a sudden, that threat doesn't seem so bad anymore. So we will see how it shakes out, but the stakes seem pretty high.
All of this, of course, coming on the heels of a Washington Post report from earlier in the week that North Korea now has missile-ready nuclear weapons that can fit inside their ballistic missiles. Well, that's one story from the Washington Post this week. And as we know now, Jim, without the Washington Post, democracy will die in darkness. Mm. In the light, however, anarchy is beloved. And that's what the story that we learned on Thursday. The title is, What Draws Americans to Anarchy? It's More Than Just Smashing Windows. Perry Stein is the author. By day, they are graphic designers, legal assistants, nonprofit workers, and students. But outside their 9-to-5 jobs, they call themselves anarchists, bucking the system, shunning the government, and sometimes even riding and smashing windows to make a point. Dylan Petrohilos, 28, and his family's struggle with poverty drew him to the movement. Sammy LeMaster, 22, first became involved because of her belief that the country needs a stronger response to shootings by police. Legba Carrefour, 37, has been protesting for well over a decade. The trio are among a group of Washington area residents who have been quietly active in gay rights demonstrations, Black Lives Matter, and many other causes. But their anarchist community made a fiery entrance into the Trump presidency on January 20th when they organized thousands of people to protest his inauguration by blocking security checkpoints and marching in the streets. Hundreds of them, clad in black clothes and masks, rioted through the downtown. They used wooden poles and pieces of concrete to break storefronts and smash newspaper boxes, according to an indictment in D.C. Superior Court. More than 200 people were arrested, and 6 police officers were injured. City officials tally the damage from the rioting at about $100,000. What the court documents call malicious and violent acts, the anarchists see as a necessary way to draw attention to poverty, racism, educational inequality, and other problems. Here's a couple of other clips from the story. LeMaster said she used to consider herself a far-left Democrat. As a student at American University, she surrounded herself with progressive friends but grew tired with her peers' politics by her senior year. They would rant on Facebook about the latest news, then do little to solve the problems that vexed them. When people started rioting in Baltimore after the death of Freddie Gray in 2015, she recalls some of her classmates being shocked by the violence and saying they could no longer support Black Lives Matter. Quote, I was like, of course they're breaking windows. They're mad, she said. That's going to make you stop supporting Black Lives Matter? Later on, she says, it takes a while to get used to the label of anarchist because it comes with a lot of baggage. People assume that anarchism is so extreme, but I associate it with wanting everyone's needs met. So, Jim, I can only imagine. I mean, I don't have to imagine. Remember the Tea Party protesters who actually picked up litter off the mall and how badly they were denigrated by the Washington Post and other liberal media outlets? These are the people literally causing property damage to people completely unrelated to their cause, and they're getting this sympathetic, velvety profile in the Washington Post.
You know, my first question upon hearing that description from you, Greg, is since when does a guy named Corumbus not know how to pronounce a Greek name? Moving on from that. So based on this, Greg, should we, after we're finished taping, go over and smash their stuff? Anarchy, man. There's no rules, no laws. What you did really offended me, and I'm making a statement against destruction of private property by destroying your private property. How do you like that, pal? You know, and some might say, wait a minute, that makes perfect sense. That is turnabout being fair play. I think the better and more revealing aspect here is that could you ever conceive of the Washington Post writing this kind of sympathetic portrayal or portrait of any right-wing group that used violence in any form?
Of course not.
Any militia group, those guys out in Idaho or out in Oregon or something. No, sorry, I just don't buy it. I don't think they'd ever do that. And this effort, we got to understand. God, don't they have noble motives, and they just want a better... They would just never do that. And most of us, because we have this broad societal agreement. You know, your right to free speech ends at the bridge of my nose. And, you know, if you can't smash stuff that doesn't belong to you. If they had smashed the windows of the Washington Post building, would the portrayal have been as positive in the style section? And I'm glad that they're not generally violent people. But the idea of I'm really angry about a particular political issue, thus I am allowed to destroy your stuff, we don't recognize that as a legitimate argument from anybody in society. So why is the Washington Post saying, no, wait, hear them out. They have a point. No, they don't. At least we want to smash something, Greg.
here's the closing paragraph, and this goes back to the Greek guy. I'll let people decide how to pronounce his name. Petrahilos is how I'll say it. Remember, he's an anarchist. This is his quote. The main principles of anarchism is solidarity and the importance of solidarity within society. So I think it's incredibly important.
Wait a minute. No, it's not. Get a dictionary, pal.
So I think it's incredibly...
You're the most collectivist anarchist I've ever seen.
Oh, let me finish the quote. So I think it's incredibly important that people are showing up for each other when we are seeing the harshest state repression in a generation. he has no idea what anarchism is. And, you know, Dinesh D'Souza has the new book out calling the left the actual fascists. I don't know if he's going to want this for an addendum to the book, but it's pretty good.
Earlier this week, I'd raised the question of how do you feel about the Google executive versus Colin Kaepernick? Generally, people believe, well, people I like should be treated with respect, but people I don't like don't deserve respect, protection of law, or anything else. And this guy's, you know, like the most vivid example you can possibly imagine of that. Because he doesn't like you, your stuff, because he doesn't agree with you, your stuff can be smashed. And that's, you know, that's thuggishness. That's not a philosophy.
Exactly. All right. Quickly on to our crazy martini now. And one of the folks that has been most pro-Trump over at CNN for the past couple of years, Jeffrey Lord of the American Spectator, served in the Reagan administration. Well, he's now a former CNN contributor. He was fired by CNN yesterday after he tweeted Sieg Heil during what the Daily Beast calls a fractious back and forth with the head of Media Matters for America. And of course, they're out to silence the right and to point out bias as they see it in favor of the right. They hate Fox News. They hate talk radio. And of course, anybody who shows up on a left-leaning network from a right-wing perspective would also count, and that would include Jeffrey Lord. And so they were in this big fight back and forth about Media Matters trying to get sponsors to drop Sean Hannity and so forth. And so that was where Lord came in saying that that's what fascists do, and then another back and forth, and ultimately the Sieg Heil, which is probably never a good way to go. But Jim, it obviously was a back and forth with a left-wing organization that likes to bait. Some might miss Jeffrey Lord more than others, but what do you make of how his tenure at CNN came to an end?
You know, things are going really off the rails when I feel a twinge of sympathy for Jeff Lord, because I'm not a particularly big fan. In fact, I do believe sometime during the Tea Party days, I was a groveling servant of the ruling establishment or something like that. I wrote that, you know, that's the dumbest thing he'd written ever. And, you know, several of his colleagues happened to write in and say, Jim, that's not even the dumbest thing he's written this month. Look, the problem is that if you're going to fire somebody, I think a glaringly obvious sarcastic Sieg Heil, right? It's not that, you know, Jeff Lord is saying, I love Nazis. What he's saying is, I think you're acting like a Nazi to the Media Matters guy. And I can, while it's, you know, they're Godwin's law is in effect, and generally Nazi metaphors tend to not work out well and backfire for the person using them, really, it's very hard to believe that at any point Jeff Lord was generally endorsing anything like this. Even the people who work with him and can't stand him ideologically say he's the nicest guy in the world. And in fact, my personal interactions with him have generally been polite. He's not a frothing at the mouth, angry guy, nor is he anybody who walks around goose stepping or anything like that. Now, here's the thing. Is possibly this was the last straw because Jeff Lord tends to... let's say, I don't think he always makes the strongest argument to defend his points. He's very clearly of the philosophy that Trump can do no wrong. His critics never have a valid point. I believe back in when you know, there was allegations of whether Trump had obstructed justice, Jeff referred to it as a high-tech lynching. A lot of people did not particularly like that metaphor. There are lots of times where you can have a particular debate. And not only that, a particular type of CNN debate. And boy, I hope they invite me back on after this discussion. that there's, you know, that there's a tone, there's a style, and you know, Jeff Lord kind of bursts through the wall like the Kool-Aid guy, and makes an argument that is utterly, you know, not only disagreed with, but you know, right up to the line of offensive of or absurd to many of the other folks at CNN. One that kind of sticks out is he says, you know, I remember it was back in June. I went back and looked, you know. He said it'd be fair for Trump to criticize Ariana Grande for not providing enough security. Now, look, we have our beefs with Ariana Grande, but I don't think at that particular moment, right after the terror attack at her concert, you want to say, ah, it's her fault or something like that. He insisted that Trump's attacks on Mika Brzezinski wasn't sexist. This is when Trump was talking about her plastic surgery and things like that. You know, he contended that Trump would, quote, have a huge political advantage if he fired Robert Mueller. So here's the thing. If you're CNN and you don't like the way Jeff Lord is doing his job as your pro-Trump talking head on your network, then fire him over that, right? Like, just come out and say, look, this is just not the tone or style of discussion. We don't think you're really adding much to what we're trying to do here. We feel like there's got to be some other less incendiary or more compelling or more convincing Trump defender than you, Jeff. You know, happy trails. Thanks for working for us. Don't latch on to this one sarcastic tweet as the excuse to say, all right, that's it, you're out of here. Particularly when you know Media Matters is getting to this. You know, like, people get into heated Twitter fights with disturbing regularity. Should Americans fight on Twitter less? Yes. You know, have I found myself getting really mad at somebody who's an egg and who has four followers and who called me stupid, and I want to say, no, you're stupid. And that, you know, do I find it doesn't bring out the best in us. Do you want to fire a guy over it? I think if you're going to do it, you really need that tweet really has to be beyond the pale and the sort of thing where you really don't want to be associated with this person anymore. And I don't know if a sarcastic Sieg Heil does it. I just don't believe there's enough evidence to conclude, no, it was not sarcastic. He was not mocking the person he was arguing. He really legitimately meant it. I'd feel better if CNN was being honest about it. And they said, look, we're tired of Jeff Lord. Fine. Okay, that happens. You're an at-will employee in this world. But be honest about it. Don't hide behind a particular Twitter exchange to say, oh, this is really the reason and, you know, we fear we've had a Nazi on staff for the past 18 months or something like that. Because nobody buys into that.
No. Jim, so we've got threats of nuclear war. We've got the Washington Post celebrating anarchists. And we've got firing for a really weak reason when there's plenty of other good reasons to make the decision. I think you need a vacation.
Guess what, folks? That's the news. And I am out of here, at least for the following week. Greg, enjoy it. I hope there's an America to come back to a week from now.
Jim, enjoy the vacation. We will soldier on here at the 3-Martini Lunch. David French will be in for Jim all of next week. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Have a great weekend, everyone, and tune in on Monday for the next 3-Martini Lunch.